From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. There are 4 days to go until the election. The polls are tightening. The candidates have been racing around the country giving their closing arguments. So it is time for our last pre-election weekly roundtable.
Here and Now!
2016!
Miss the cheerful timepiece quartet mostly. Jesse Holland covers politics and ethnicity for the Associated Press. Hi, Jesse.
How are you doing today?
Good. Julie Mason is host of the Press Pool on Sirius XM. Hi, Julie.
Not going to miss the quartet. I can't lie.
They've just been,
cheerful. It was a volunteer mission.
So we thank them. But Julie, start with you. I want to get from both of you the temperature. How do you see the race?
The race is crazy right now. Democrats have reason to be concerned. There's a lot of worry that everything's wrong. The polls are wrong. We've been wrong. This sort of last-minute panic that Trump may have a path, but she still has a better ground game, and the polls are looking in her favor. It's just, we don't know.
Yeah. Well, Jesse, I'm looking up at the CNN new electoral map. They say that Hillary Clinton might be short of the 270, the magic 270. You know, we keep hearing that Utah, which might actually go blue, might knock Donald Trump off that magic 270 that you need in the Electoral College. Your thoughts?
Well, it's all down to turnout now. It's all down to who can get their people to the polls. And one of the things we have to keep in mind when we start talking about these last days is that because of early voting, more than a fifth of the country has already cast their vote. So when we talk about these last second polls, are we talking about the people who have already voted? So those numbers could shift a lot of those states right there by themselves.
Well, Trump spoke in Grand Rapids, Michigan on Monday. Let's listen to him. He has been racing around the country. Here he is.
She's unfit and unqualified to be the president of the United States, and her election would mire our government and our country in a constitutional crisis that we cannot afford. Folks, we have to get back to work. We have to get back to work.
And then here is Hillary Clinton in Cleveland on Monday.
There is no case here. And they said it wasn't even a close call. And I think most people have decided a long time ago what they think about all of this. Now what people are focused on is choosing the next president and commander-in-chief of the United States of America.
When she says there is no case here, she's, of course, talking about an FBI case involving her emails. Julie, what does Trump have to do in these last few days in order to win?
Well, it's been amazing to watch Trump in the last, I don't know, week or 10 days. He has gone from just, you know, screaming and yelling about everything in the polls and it's all rigged. He's talking about Common Core and other education policies. He's fleshing out some more policy initiatives. He's trying to stick to his script and not make too many mistakes. It's been incredible to watch. And his polls have improved a little bit. But a lot of it is Hillary Clinton coming down a bit rather than Trump really improving his performance in the polls.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to ask. Trump was talking about the constitutional crisis. And Jesse, he's, of course, referring to what many Republicans hope, that there will be an indictment against Hillary Clinton, that there might even be an impeachment. But Julie, when you talk about Donald Trump saying the voting is rigged, Democrats are in courts today as we speak, claiming that the RNC has been working with the Trump campaign to, you know, suppress votes. There's a background here. In the 80s, the RNC, it was alleged, did try to suppress votes. They're under a decree that they can't do that for another year. Talk about the messiness we might see at the polls.
Well, in the last couple.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jesse. Go ahead.
No. In the last couple of days of any election, you see these accusations being thrown around back and forth. But one thing that we can be guaranteed with any presidential election right now is there's going to be a fight in the courts over something. And so, in North Carolina, Democrats are complaining about vote suppression. Donald Trump's been talking about about a rigged election for I don't know how long now. So we can expect to see some type of court battle. This is why a lot of people are hoping that the race will be decisive one way or the other, so we don't have a repeat of 2000. But especially since we have a 4-4 split Supreme Court now. But I think we're going to see some kind of court challenge. But the question is going to be how big of a challenge is going to be.
Right. You remember 4-4 split court? It was a 5-4 vote in the Al Gore Bush race. Now it would be have to go back down to a lower court. But Jeremy, pick it up.
Please not.
Let's not go there,
please. Julie, I asked you about what Trump has has to do? What does Hillary Clinton need to do in these last few days to win?
Well, and her case is interesting too, Jeremy. I'm sure you know she was hoping to end on a positive note. You know, it's been such a terrible, bruising, soiling campaign. And she wanted to go out strong. She wanted to go out positive, talking about her message and her achievements. And that was the game plan. But with the Comey thing and the questions about the rigged election and all this other stuff, she had to dump that plan. And now she's just going hard against Trump. He's not fit. He can't serve. And she's getting a strong lift from the Obama's, for example, and her other surrogates. It's not clear that they can help her over the finish line, but man, they're all working hard.
Well, it's not just that she's fighting the FBI, perhaps, investigation, but here is sound of Hillary Clinton on Tuesday in Fort Lauderdale shouting over protesters saying Bill Clinton is a rapist.
It is time for us to say no. We are not going backwards. We're going forward into a brighter future.
Jesse Holland, weigh in.
Well, it's one of the interesting things about this election is that we've seen people try to drag Bill Clinton into the argument, even though Bill Clinton is actually not on the ballot. It's Hillary. It's his wife on the ballot. So we've seen a lot of nastiness in the election from both sides. And we actually saw Melania Trump actually reemerge yesterday and try to give a speech on cyberbullying. So we're seeing a lot of people throwing everything up against the walls at the last second in hopes of getting a push one way or the other.
Let's hear Melania from yesterday.
It is absolutely unacceptable when it's done by someone with no name hiding on the internet. We have to find a better way to talk to each other, to disagree with each other, to respect each other.
A lot of people pointing out that obviously Donald Trump has done a lot of, I guess you could say, cyberbullying of people mm-hmm. throughout the course of this campaign.
But
and
his
before
name's
it.
On it.
But the other thing is, you know, Melania Trump's most famous speech before that one was the one at the convention, which was plagiarized from Michelle Obama's speech. And yesterday I Googled one of the phrases that she said, if you could dream it, you could become it. The only result in Google is a quote from Marla Maples, which I'll just put that out there for you. But.
It also sounds like the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Don't dream it, be it. Remember that song at the end?
Well, but this idea, I mean, someone's saying was, you know, now the conversation is, was a poor spouse sent out to say words, not, you know, not even maybe realizing. I mean, the impact of that. Matthew Dowd tweeted out, Melania Trump speaking out against cyberbullying is like Bernie Madoff's wife speaking out against Ponzi schemes.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
it is.
Wow.
It is. The irony is deep.
Okay. Well, your thoughts on a couple of the news items that we're hearing today. Bridgegate, two of Chris Christie's top aides have been convicted of conspiring to foul up the traffic, to punish a mayor who wouldn't support the governor. You know, he is obviously not on the ticket, but a top advisor to Donald Trump. Julie, does this have any impact?
Sure it does. And you can think, boy, what if Christie was the nominee at this point? He is heading Donald Trump's transition, which is not a small thing. And if Donald Trump is elected, Chris Christie would be looking for a very high profile position in the cabinet. If Donald Trump is elected now, this puts that into serious doubt.
It looks like Christie is scheduled to be campaigning tomorrow in New Hampshire for Donald Trump. So we'll see what happens there. Jesse, it was exactly a week ago right now that we got news about the FBI looking into more emails related to Hillary Clinton's private server. Here we are 4 days out. Are you expecting any big game changer over the next few days?
It would be hard to see something coming out in the next few days. But this has been one of those election cycles where you can't say anything and be positive about it. You could see the FBI come out and say, well, there's nothing here or there's something here between now and the election. But it would actually be shocking to see something come out this late in the game.
But what about
that
WikiLeaks?
Would affect the race?
What about WikiLeaks?
But, who knows
what about
WikiLeaks?
Al-Qaeda?
What about who knows what could happen? This has been one of those years where we have no idea what's going to happen between now and Tuesday. We just all along for the ride.
Yeah. Look, to both of you, we've got about a minute left. Do you think, and we talked about whether or not it was going to be a landslide so that there are no legal cases afterwards, but what about general legal cases? Both candidates are pointing at the other for having legal problems that would come up if that candidate was president. Julie?
Yeah, one-term president. Either one, one-term.
Yeah, because, and let's remind people, there are lawsuits against Trump University. There's an allegation against Donald Trump. He's appearing in court, an allegation of rape against Donald Trump. The Republicans point to what they think is going to be an indictment of Hillary Clinton because of her emails. Jesse.
One of the things that you can guarantee is that whoever wins the election, there will be hearings in Congress, there will be hearings in court that will start almost immediately next year.
Oh, joy.
The spittle will fly.
democracy.
Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on SiriusXM, and Jesse Holland, who covers politics and ethnicity for the Associated Press. I can't believe we're 4 days away, but thank you for being here on our last pre-election roundtable, guys.
Thank you
very much.
Today, Democrats are arguing in a federal court in New Jersey that Republicans are coordinating with Donald Trump to intimidate voters. That same claim will be heard in state courts as well. The Republican Party denies it, and yesterday a federal judge in Las Vegas said he saw no signs of Trump's campaign training people to intimidate voters. Donald Trump has been calling on supporters to be election observers. Here he is October 18th in Grand Junction, Colorado.
Look, if nothing else, people are going to be watching on November 8th. Watch Philadelphia. Watch St. Louis.
Jeff Scoop has taken up that call, although he says while he shares Donald Trump's views, his group is not endorsing Donald Trump. Jeff Scoop is commander of the Nationalist Socialist Party. He'll be leading a rally outside the Pennsylvania state capitol in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, tomorrow, Saturday. In April, he was instrumental in uniting more than a dozen white supremacist groups in the umbrella group the Nationalist Front. He says he prefers nationalists and rejects supremacists because he and his followers, he says, don't want to rule other races. They want a separate white country of their own, preferably the whole U.S., but within it if need be. And Jeff Scoop joins us by cell phone from Pennsylvania. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. What do you hope to achieve on Saturday?
You know, we're looking to reach out to the white people in the region. We do want people to get out and engage in the political process. We're also out there to spread our message and recruit and build our ranks in the state of Pennsylvania.
But I also understand that you're encouraging people not just to vote, but to go poll watch, monitor.
Yes, we are engaging in that this year. There's a lot of concern about electoral fraud and vote rigging and things of that nature. And we've seen that in American politics a little bit in the past. You know, there was charges of that when the Al Gore campaign in Florida with the charge and things like that. And in other races, too, I mean, there's been instances here where people that are in graveyards have casted votes, illegal aliens have casted votes, and things of that nature. So, yes, I mean, we are going to be posted at polling stations, around the country and looking out for these kind of things.
Well, but there's been very little in recent history, very little voter fraud. And there's only been one incident of voter fraud in early election this cycle, but it was a Trump candidate who voted twice. And ironically, she says it's because, you know, hearing this kind of language about there being voter fraud, she was afraid her vote wouldn't count. So she voted twice and is in deep trouble for it. You know, do you worry that you're ginning up anger at something that doesn't exist?
Well, I mean, this is, you know, I mean, that's your opinion. And I mean, I've heard of different things of this nature. I mean, that whole subject could be up for debate.
Well, not really. It's not just my opinion either. The Brennan Center for Justice, most scholars call voter fraud a myth. Factcheck.org's headline is Trump's Bogus Voter Fraud Claims. You can Google it.
If we're wrong and there is no voter fraud, you know, that's great. You know, but we just want everything to run smoothly and that the votes actually count for something.
But do you worry that your desire to monitor polls might turn into suppression of the vote? Some of your fellow white nationalists say that is their intent. Andrew Anglin, he founded the neo-Nazi website Stormer. He says he's going to go into what he calls the ghettos and hand out liquor and marijuana to get African-American residents to stay home. Do you support that?
I'm not going to comment on that. That's not, you know, everybody's got their own tactics, but I'm not commenting on that.
Yeah, but can you condemn it?
Well, I mean, I don't know what other people are engaged in. The National Socialist Movement's not doing that, I can tell you that.
Okay. But what do you plan on doing? Because, you know, to be a monitor, that's an official thing. In Pennsylvania, where you are, poll watchers have to be registered. What are you telling people to do? Because it's too late to register as an official monitor.
Right. Basically, we are going to be around the polling areas. Intimidating people away from voting or things of that nature is some sort of federal crime. So I mean, that's not the new Black Panther Party got in some trouble for that, for standing outside of polling stations. I think it was in Philadelphia, actually. So we're not doing that. You know, we're basically going to just be there very discreetly.
Well, yeah, you're right. The law says poll watchers or anyone forbidden from any conduct that might intimidate voters, including approaching them or challenging them directly.
Correct.
Look, there's been some concern that Donald Trump won't concede if he loses. Will you accept a Donald Trump loss?
Well, I mean, the idea of a Hillary presidency is pretty frightening to pretty much all white nationalists. Hillary Clinton is very close to a communist.
And why does Donald Trump appeal to you?
He is tackling a lot of nationalist issues, and he is speaking about America First, which has been one of our party platforms from day one. He's speaking about stopping the tide of illegal immigration. You know, nationalism is rising all around the world right now, and now it's going to be happening here in the United States.
I'm looking at some quotes from Matthew Heimbach, who's with the Traditionalist Workers Party. It's part of your umbrella group. He's going to be at your rally on Saturday, and he talks about awakening the sleeping Occidental giant. No Jew is going to tell us what to do. And he goes on to say the Trump phenomenon is a sign that the bull is beginning to stir. The rage many white people have caged up inside is beginning to break the surface. And evidence is found in the overwhelming support for Donald Trump. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with that 100%.
Well, just one last question. America's always been a polyglot, a melting pot, always been a mixing bowl. Aren't you being un-American?
It's absolutely not un-American. Especially the immigrants that are coming from a lot of the third world places now, they're trying to change our language. You know, when people came here from all of Europe, they had to learn our language here. They had to adjust and adapt to our culture. Now it's becoming, they're changing the whole dynamic of what being an American is all about.
Jeff, just briefly, where's your family from? I'm going to let you go. Where is your family from originally?
Europe, of course.
Which part?
I'm not going to answer that.
Okay.
I'm not going to get into that.
Yeah. Okay. That's Jeff Scoop, commander of the Nationalist Socialist Party. Jeff, thanks for speaking with us.
Yep.
And by the way, he mentioned that the Black Panthers getting in trouble. This was in 2008. It was actually a member of the Black Panthers who carried a baton to a polling place in Philadelphia. The Black Panthers disavowed him. Well, now to big news out of New Jersey. A federal jury has found two former aides to New Jersey Governor Chris Christie guilty on all counts in the so-called Bridgegate trial. Bridget Ann Kelly and Bill Baroni were convicted of conspiring to close lanes on the George Washington Bridge back in 2013, to create a major traffic jam to get back at the mayor of Fort Lee for not endorsing Governor Christie's reelection bid. Joe Hernandez, of Here and Now contributor WHYY, has been covering that trial. Joe, how did Kelly and Baroni react?
Well, it was very tense in the courtroom, Robin. Kelly sobbed throughout the verdict. As you said, they were found guilty on all counts. Kelly was sobbing. Her lawyer was reassuring her. Baroni was a little bit tougher to see. I could kind of see the back of his head, but he looked disappointed. After the verdict was read, he smiled again and as he hugged his family. But they both looked very disappointed.
Well, we've talked about the trial. There were emails from Kelly saying things like time to start traffic problems. And when she was told there were traffic problems, emails of her saying things like, am I smiling? But today her lawyer called her a scapegoat. And Mike Baldessari, the lawyer for Bill Baroni, had this to say.
Tell me what this case was about. This case was and is a disgrace.
Remind us of what both Baroni and Kelly said further and what the charges were against them, because they plan to appeal.
Well, the two of them were charged with closing lanes at the George Washington Bridge to create these massive traffic jams for 4 days to retaliate against a Democratic mayor there who didn't endorse Governor Chris Christie for reelection. There was a third person involved in this, a guy named David Wildstein, who also worked at the Port Authority, who pleaded guilty. Kelly and Baroni did make that argument in court, that they were scapegoats, that they didn't know the extent of the political motivations, but jurors decided that that wasn't true. There was a bit of a dispute in court over whether the motivations actually had played a role in whether they were guilty or not of the crimes. Ultimately, ultimately jurors decided it didn't matter. They were guilty.
Well, the biggest question of all is, what did Chris Christie know and when? And after the verdict, the reporters asked U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman, why not prosecute Governor Christie if all the evidence in the courtroom pointed to him?
Well, I'm not going to answer the question why I did or didn't pursue anybody in particular. What I will say is exactly what I said at the news conference that we had when the indictment was returned in May of 2015, which is, at the time, we indicted only the people who we believed we had evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, which, as you know, is the constitutional standard, evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to convict in this courthouse.
Well, Joe Hernandez, he said at the time, and he seemed to put a lot of emphasis on that. What do you make of that?
Well, reporters love to ask Fishman this question. Why didn't he prosecute Christie? And he always gives the same answer, that he doesn't comment on why he didn't charge certain people with certain crimes. Reporters also asked Fishman, now that the trial has been concluded, might he charge Christie? Because several witnesses said, yes, Christie knew about this lane closure scheme. And some people, Kelly herself, said he even was OK with it. Fishman is notoriously tight-lipped about this. He won't say whether anyone is charged. And he also said that testimony during the case wouldn't be admissible. Christie still denies that any part in it.
Here's what Chris Christie said in a statement after the verdict. He said he's saddened by the conduct of some members of my administration who showed a lack of respect for the appropriate role of government and for the people we serve. But let me be clear, I had no knowledge prior to or during these lane realignments and no role in authorizing them. No believable evidence was presented to contradict that fact. Joe Hernandez of Here Now contributed WHYY. Again, two of Christie's top aides have been convicted in the so-called Bridgegate scandal. Joe, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Today, the Labor Department reported that the unemployment rate fell to 4.9% in October, improving slightly over September, and the economy added 161,000 jobs. Mike Regan is columnist at Bloomberg Gadfly. He joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
So it's obviously always good to add jobs, which we did, and it's good to see the unemployment rate go down, which it did. But how good is this report?
I would describe it as about as good as you can expect at this point in the economic cycle. That main headline number of 161,000 jobs, it was about 12,000 jobs short of what the consensus estimate from economists was. But the revisions to September and August added about 44,000 jobs, more than previously reported. So that more than makes up for that miss. And one interesting factoid I saw is that among the unemployed, the share of people leaving jobs voluntarily jumped to 12%, which is the highest since before the financial crisis began. And that sort of shows you that people have enough confidence in the job market to quit their job and go look for a new one.
So when we look at where those 161,000 jobs were, what sectors are they in?
Yeah, that's another pretty positive takeaway from this report, is that the growth was in pretty well-paying sectors. Healthcare, for example, added about 31,000 jobs. And professional and business services, which is a broad category, they continued a trend of very good growth with 43,000 jobs added. Even the financial sector continued to add jobs, about 14,000 jobs there. So pretty well-paying jobs helped to boost the growth.
What happened with wages overall? That's another thing that we find out in these monthly surveys.
Yeah, and they were stronger than expected. Year over year, wages were up 2.8%, and that's the best increase since 2009. And it really suggests that the job market is getting strong enough to provide a better boost to wages, which have been kind of anemic throughout this economic recovery. It's something a lot of people have been worried about.
So obviously, this comes just a few days before the election, and we could talk all day about what kind of impact this might have and how this makes people feel about the economy in the United States under President Obama. But we also know that the Federal Reserve watches this number very closely. What might they do?
Well, it definitely reinforces this sort of consensus idea that a rate increase in December is getting to be a pretty high probability. The wild card, obviously, is the financial markets, the stock and bond markets. And they've become very jittery over the last week because of increased uncertainty in the election as the poll numbers really tighten considerably. So a big freak out in the markets with a lot of selling of stocks would be possibly the one thing that could push a rate increase off into the future.
So if the market starts falling, then the Fed would say, no, in fact, we're going to wait even longer.
I think that's a possibility, yeah. And I think a lot of people believe that's what caused them to wait over the summer when the Brexit vote in Great Britain really roiled markets. They don't want to add to the fuel to the fire. If markets are very jittery, the belief is that a rate increase could exacerbate things. So they might wait until things calm down. But that's only if there's big surprises in the election and markets really freak out over it.
That's Mike Regan, the columnist at Bloomberg Gadfly, with the latest on the jobs report. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Did you know that Susan B. Anthony's dying words were a lament that she worked all her life to get women the vote and never got it, especially for herself? That Franz Liszt died right after watching a performance of Parsifal? Or that Abraham Lincoln's wife was allowed to embrace her dying husband for only a few minutes before she was removed, sobbing? Details like those are just part of what makes the newly released The New York Times Book of the Dead such great reading. The tome, and it's a big one, is a compilation of 320 of the newspaper's most important obituaries from the last 165 years. The entry is not only a great who's who in history, but also a fascinating look into the times in which these people lived and died. William McDonald is the New York Times obituary editor. He compiled the 320 entries, and he joins us from NPR's New York studios. Welcome.
Thank you.
And, you know, I'm one who reads them every day. What do you think it is about an obituary? And they're more popular than ever.
I think people like to read about other people's lives in general. I think there's a certain amount of curiosity and maybe nosiness at times. But I think they tell you about, you know, how important people live, how they got to be where they were. And it's good narrative writing. It's biography. It's history. I think it's a rich part of the paper.
Well, also, you can see how they were viewed in the time. Here's the beginning of Henry Clay's obituary. He died in 1852. It reads, "How the concerns of life and death intermingle. Amid the hot contention of political strife, a slow, dull sound filling every ear brings the long-expected annunciation that Henry Clay is no more." It's just beautiful.
We don't write like that anymore.
Tell us, who was he and what do they have to say about him?
Well, Henry Clay was one of the great orators and one of the great senators of American history. He and Daniel Webster, I think, were the lions of the Senate leading up to the Civil War. And it's a great example of that kind of obituary from that period, very florid.
Well, and you learn, you know, he lost four daughters to an infancy, mm-hmm. two at the age of 14, mm-hmm. Volunteered his legal services to rescue people from slavery. It's got quite a lot of humanity in it. Abraham Lincoln's obit was interesting to you, but it was more a news story.
It was. It was one of the interesting things I discovered in looking back at the old newspapers. Lincoln did not get an obituary per se, not the way we would think of one, the complete biography. It was essentially a news report of the great calamity, as it was described in the headline, you know, a blow-by-blow kind of account of what happened at Ford Theater and the aftermath. And, of course, at that point, I don't think Booth had been caught. And the Times really didn't publish an obituary even days later in that sense. That I had to search and found finally a eulogy written by a minister in New York who kind of gave us a kind of overview of his life, but that was essentially it.
Yeah, well, we learned that pennies were placed on Abraham Lincoln's eyelids, but they were later mm-hmm. replaced by silver half dollars. Details like that.
Yeah, the details in obituaries, I think, are also what draws people. We try to mix both detail and the big picture story, the sweep of history. And so it's that combination, that granular detail with the great historical currents, you might say, that makes it such a good read, I think.
Robert E. Lee, you say an obit that was respectful but unsympathetic.
Well, you know, the Times was, of course, a pro-Union paper. Lee died 5 years after the war ended, so feelings were still raw. And the Times made a point of saying that almost a lament that he had chosen to leave the Union. He was in the Union Army and take up arms against his own country. It talked about him as a traitor. You don't get that kind of kindly uncle that maybe others perceived Lee to be.
Well, they did say he was efficient and prompt.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's not exactly stirring. Dred Scott's staying mm-hmm. with the anti-slavery mm-hmm. movement. It is an obit that acknowledges his contribution, but also concludes that there were so many setbacks for him that they only hope that in his death he has a better freedom.
Yeah. It was kind of a moving obit. It paid tribute to him as a human being, you might say, after the Supreme Court had essentially denied that he was a man or a citizen. And I'm sure this was in 1858, before the Civil War. So to, you know, memorialize a slave in that way was probably a bold thing to do.
No big deal, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Move to Susan B. Anthony. A friend says in her obituary that her last words were, "To think I have had more than 60 years of hard struggle for a little liberty, mm-hmm. and then to die without it seems so cruel."
Yeah.
That's a pretty focused thing to say when you're on your deathbed. Do we trust it?
That's a good question. That's one of the issues, I suppose, in reading a lot of these, particularly the older obituaries. We don't know what kind of fact-checking was going on back then. A lot of them read like tributes and eulogies, so they'd be very florid. And who knows whether they were just perpetuating legends and urban myths and such. I'd probably read them with at least a medium-sized grain of salt, but they make for good stories, if nothing else.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I mean, it's a terrible story that I'm about to mention, but I didn't realize it was so laid out in Isadora Duncan's obituary when she died in 1927. Mm-hmm. She, of course, the American dancer, very, very flamboyant in her dress. And many people know that she died when she had a scarf wrapped around her neck and it got caught in the wheel of a car. But boy, do they go into the detail in the obituary. It began, she was in Paris, the limousine going at full speed when the scarf suddenly began winding around the wheel and with terrific force dragged Miss Duncan, around whom it was securely wrapped, over the side of the car, precipitating her with violence against the cobblestone street. She was dragged for some, it goes on and on.
In that particular story, it was also more of a news account than, the full-fledged obit. A lot of the obits from those days would often assume the readers knew enough about the subject that they didn't feel they had to go into the biography. And we don't have that attitude now, even though, readers presumably know the story of, say, a David Bowie or, a Muhammad Ali. We still give you the reading experience of the full story. Didn't seem to do that in the old days.
Well, I was thinking a couple of things. First of all, I'm looking at Jim Henson's 1990. After reading Isadora Duncan or even Henry Clay, you then look at the modern day ones and they seem a little dry. I'm a big fan of theirs, but now that you compare them to the florid writing, they just seem a little dry.
Some can be, even from this book in the later pages, in the later century. One of the issues for the newspaper business, at least back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s even, the obituary, was not considered a prime spot to be in a newspaper. So it would often be considered a backwater and a place where old reporters went to die, in effect. And so you might not get the quality that you would want on some of these major figures. But you're right. The style of prose changes. It becomes much more direct today. We're trying to revive it a little bit. We're trying to be a little more literary, you might say, and take some chances and be a little more creative in our writing. Mm-hmm. But, it's a valid criticism, I think.
Well, it's more, just reflecting on how much more florid writing was,
Yeah. Right. It's a very different style. And I'm not sure readers would have the patience for it today, but, we reflect the times.
Or we want to hear every detail of Jim Henson's pneumococcal, infection that killed him. I mean, I'm not sure I want to hear every detail of that.
In the way that you have
Trotsky, we learn how he was killed with a pickaxe.
Right. Very, very descriptive.
Very descriptive.
You are there kind of writing. Again, it was more of a news writing exercise as opposed to, say, a biography.
Right. You point out that some were underplayed. Harriet Tubman has just a couple of paragraphs, died in 1913 and was the Moses of her people, as the first sentence says, led hundreds through her Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. Anybody just completely overlooked?
Yes. Some of the people who you might expect to be in the book or, even in the paper at the time weren't there because they really weren't discovered until much later. And I'm thinking of people like Vincent van Gogh. He did not get an obituary in the Times. Franz Kafka or Chekhov, some of the Russian, great Russian writers. I can only assume their work wasn't really widely known, I think, at the time of their deaths. And And maybe so it just didn't make no impression.
William McDonald, Bill McDonald, again, we're talking about the newly released The Book of the Dead, a huge compilation of 165 years worth of New York Times obituaries. You could just skim it forever. Oh, look, there's Jimi Hendrix and Robert Louis Stevenson.
Right.
Bill, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
This is Here and Now. The leaders of Turkey's pro-Kurdish opposition party, the HDP, were arrested today along with nine other pro-Kurdish lawmakers. Hours after the arrest, a car bomb exploded in Diyarbakir, the largest city in southeastern Turkey, killing at least eight and injuring more than 100. The BBC's Mark Lowen joins us from Istanbul, Turkey. And Mark, tell us first about the significance of these arrests. You call this a major escalation of Turkey's clampdown on the Kurds.
It is a hugely significant moment, really, because the HDP is Turkey's third largest political party. It has 59 MPs in parliament. And now the leaders of the political of the HDP are under formal arrest, and several other MPs are detained. So this appears to be a major clampdown on the pro-Kurdish political party. The government says that the HDP has not distanced itself from the PKK, Kurdish militant organization, which Turkey and the West classify as a terrorist group, and that basically the HDP has done propaganda and support for terrorism. The HDP and its supporters and the government's critics say that's completely false, that this is a legal political party which represents not only the Kurds but also other groups in Turkey, and that this is an attempt by the Turkish government to clamp down, to use the state of emergency here in Turkey at the moment since the failed coup for an increasingly autocratic president to tighten his grip. So deeply concerning times. The EU says it's extremely worried, but the concerns and worries of the EU really ceased to have an impact on the Turkish government long ago.
Does it appear that the bombing today in Diyarbakir is related to the arrests?
Quite possibly. I mean, the bombing is being blamed on the PKK, and the PKK has released a video statement saying that it is going to intensify its actions against the Turkish state in the coming weeks and months. Remember that it's about a year and a half since the ceasefire between the Turkish government and the PKK broke down. And since that ceasefire broke down, there's been this wave of attacks, tit-for-tat attacks between the PKK and the Turkish government. And today's bombing in Diyarbakir, the latest one of those, eight dead, 100 injured, a massive car bomb outside the police headquarters in the biggest Kurdish-majority city, Diyarbakir. And really, quite possibly, an immediate sort of response to the clampdown on the HDP, and a worrying omen of more violence that is now likely in the coming days and weeks.
How does this sort of battle, if you will, between Turkey's government and these various Kurdish parties or the Kurds relate to what's going on right now in Iraq, where the Kurds are helping the United States and the Iraqi government try to retake Mosul from ISIS?
Yeah, it's a really complicated picture, isn't it, Jeremy? I mean, you know, you have the Kurds who are in Syria. They are being helped by the U.S. and in Iraq, they're being helped by the U.S. to try to battle so-called Islamic State. And in fact, Turkey is helping the Kurds in Iraq to battle IS. And yet Turkey sees the Kurds in Turkey, or at least the PKK in Turkey, and what it says is it's a PKK affiliate in Syria, as terrorists. So, and Turkey has been extremely angry. The US has been a lot of bad blood between Ankara and Washington over the US support for Syrian Kurds. And remember, the US and Turkey are vital NATO allies, so it's threatened almost to basically almost kind of split the relationship. There are various editorials in the Turkish press that are saying that Hillary Clinton is too close to the Kurds in Syria, has advocated arming the Kurds. There's been a lot of speculation that the Turkish government is secretly hoping that Donald Trump wins the presidency on Tuesday because they feel that they could do business with him. So it's a very, very complicated picture in terms of the Kurdish question and the relationship between Turkey and the U.S. over this.
And when it comes to Turkey, just domestically Turkey, this is a huge country, a Muslim country, but also a democracy that's been held up by the West. And now, in addition to the people who were arrested today, many journalists have also been arrested recently by the Turkish government. What is happening to Turkey?
That's a really great question. It's what we're all asking. It's what every Turkey watcher is asking. What is happening to this country that only just a few years ago was held up as a kind of model of a Muslim democracy and the anchor of stability in a volatile Middle East, a hugely important ally for the West? And really, in the last kind of couple of years or so, it has plunged in terms of freedom of speech, in terms of freedom of for minorities, the Kurdish question. And just look at the last week, Jeremy. There's been the arrest of the mayor of Diyarbakir, a Kurd. There's been another 10,000 civil servants who've had arrest warrants issued for them, on top of the 100,000 people who have been dismissed or suspended since the failed coup in July, and 37,000 people arrested. There's been the detention of the editor of Turkey's oldest mainstream newspaper here, a secular newspaper, Cumhuriyet, and several of the staff. And now last night, the detention of the HDP leaders. So really, there is a lot of concern in Washington and Brussels and London and other Western capitals. But on the other hand, Recep Tayyip Erdogan has huge support here still. He still, in the latest popularity ratings, he gets 53%. He has a very big support base. But he's turning in on that support base. He's consolidating it with little regard, really, for the rest of the country or indeed for critics abroad.
That's the BBC's Mark Lowen joining us from Istanbul. Mark, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.